Coming up on Weekend America.
Nearly 3 million votes were cast in Minnesota's U.S. Senate race, and the winner may be decided by five people sitting in a room. I'm John Moe. This hour, navigating the murky waters of voter intent. Also, it can be hard for anyone to make sense of the attacks in Mumbai.
I don't feel that I can trust the rhetoric of news gathering in the way that I can trust the rhetoric of this poem.
A poet from India looks beyond traditional coverage. And whoever thought that old Game Boy you have would be on the cutting edge of music?
Lightspeed Lament is a song that incorporates concepts of time travel, space travel, but also this theme of space age Romeo and Juliet story, I guess.
Way cooler than Tetris, and less frustrating. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. Big weekend for shopping. A lot of people are going to be picking up the Nintendo Wii for Christmas. But someday that Wii is going to go the way of the Nintendo 64 and the Atari 2600 and ColecoVision, game platforms that have become antiquated. And when that happens, don't throw it out. It turns out old video game systems can make for pretty interesting musical instruments. We go to a music festival this hour that's unlike anything you've heard, but maybe sort of like something that you've played. What are you doing this weekend?
This weekend I will be seeing the new James Bond movie. I am really looking forward to seeing it.
Actually, I'm going to Washington, D.C. on a school trip for my Holocaust Lit class.
This weekend, I am going to my best friend's birthday party, which, in fact, is a future party.
Sunday night dinner with my sister and her husband. We hang out and drink some wine, have some good food.
Our goal, basically, is to dress up as robots and imitate what we might be in 25 years.
Wait, we're all getting turned into robots in 25 years? No one told me this. Those voices came from Lincoln, Nebraska, Washington, D.C., and St. Louis. Remember that historic election that we had a month ago? Well, it turns out it's not over. One Senate seat is not yet decided, and it's here in Minnesota, the race between incumbent Republican Senator Norm Coleman and Democratic challenger Al Franken. After the first count, Coleman was ahead by 215 votes out of nearly 3 million cast. It then went to a recount. And on Friday, state elections officials almost finished the process of reviewing every single ballot by hand. But we still don't know who the next senator is going to be in Minnesota. Curtis Gilbert is a political reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News. Hi, Curtis.
Hi, John.
What's the latest as of this morning on the recount?
All right. As of this morning, Republican Senator Norm Coleman leads Democrat Al Franken by 192 votes, but that number gets a great big asterisk for a couple of reasons. One, there seem to be some ballots that might be missing from one Minneapolis precinct, and that's why they haven't quite finished recounting everything. They're looking for those ballots that are missing. There are also some disputes over some absentee ballots that may or may not have been rejected inappropriately, but the biggest thing is these challenged ballots.
Challenge ballot. What's the what are they challenging?
All right. So when this recount process is underway, you have a couple of neutral elections officials, counting, sorting the ballots into Franken piles and Coleman piles, and then you have representatives from the two campaigns, sort of lurking over their shoulders, and if they see something amiss about any of those ballots during this process, they will challenge them, and then those go into a separate pile. So that 192 vote lead we're talking about for Coleman doesn't include 5,300 ballots that have been challenged by one campaign or the other.
Wow. And what are they? What's the argument for challenging them?
Well, the Secretary of State's office says the vast majority of these challenges are frivolous and they're going to get thrown out. In fact, the campaigns have already started pulling back some of their challenges. But we actually went through a whole bunch of them and found the same thing the Secretary of State did. Minnesota Public Radio News looked at 1,000 ballots and found, again, the vast majority of them. There's really no legal reason why that vote shouldn't be counted either for Norm Coleman or Al Franken. The campaigns actually have been, like I said, pulling back some of these. And some of the election officials were even getting frustrated with the campaigns during this process because so many of these challenges were basically bogus. At one St. Paul area precinct, we found one very frustrated election judge.
Again, not to keep asking a stupid question. What do you think is challengeable here?
I think it's beyond the Oval. I mean, it's not a clear ballot.
But what is unclear about who they intended to vote for here?
It's beyond the distinguishing Oval.
Beyond the distinguishing Oval.
Right, and there is no law in Minnesota state law against coloring outside of the lines when you're filling out that little oval on your ballot. So that's an example of a frivolous challenge. Most of them are frivolous, but they're not all frivolous.
Like, which ones aren't?
Well, okay, so there are some that are a lot harder to tell who they should be counted for. Like, if someone filled in a dot in between the two candidates, that's going to be a tough call. And basically, all of these are going to be decided by a panel of four judges plus the Secretary of State that's going to have to go through all those ballots one by one and decide who to count them for. And, you know, like I said, some of them are hard to tell, and then some of them are just plain weird.
Such as.
Okay, well, for instance, one person maybe wrote a poem all over their ballot. And another person filled in the bubble next to Democrat Al Franken, but then also wrote in the write-in line, lizard people.
It's been an exciting race. So really, the margin is so small that it's going to come down to these four judges and the Secretary of State sitting in a room here in St. Paul, judging these hard-to-judge ballots, and that's what's going to decide this.
It very well could come down to making these tough calls on these really oddball ballots. That's right.
It's you're not getting much sleep these days, Curtis. But thank you for following the case.
I'll do my best.
Curtis Gilbert is a political reporter for Minnesota Public Radio News. You can see some of these disputed ballots. Some of them are quite artistic, and you can judge the intent for yourself. That's at weekendamerica.org. So there's urgency in Minnesota. There's also urgency around the country on the economy. And the talk this weekend is once again turning to bailouts. And this time it's the U.S. auto industry, the heads of whom were in Washington again this week asking for $34 billion. Congress rejected their request earlier, but this time the non-private jet-flying CEOs arrived against the backdrop of a huge increase in unemployment last month. Pressure is being ratcheted up. Congress hasn't voted on the bailout package yet, but they're hammering out a $15 billion short-term loan to the big three, and they're going to vote on that in a special session next week. In the meantime, our reporter, Chrissy Clark, has been asking you guys, our listeners, what you would do to help out the auto industry. And you have been flooding her with your ideas about how to make American cars awesome again and potentially save the companies. Here are some of Chrissy's favorite ideas.
You called in with all kinds of ideas, big ones, small ones, futuristic ones, nostalgic ones. The only common theme was relief that finally someone was asking you what you want in a car.
I've been wanting to get this off my chest forever.
Since the 1970s.
It's kind of one of my pet ideas.
Some of you want a full-blown big three paradigm shift.
My idea is to snatch up one of these companies, buy it outright.
Like Lorelei Pepe, a listener from Rhode Island.
And hold an American national competition for a brilliant new economical green technology car.
Golly, it doesn't have to have anything very exotic in terms of technology.
Donald Klein from Bluff City, Tennessee, thinks cars could be greener and cheaper if they were just smaller, way smaller.
Kind of not much more than something like a motorcycle with an enclosure that keeps rain out. And it ought to have a place to put a sack of groceries and two people. You ought to get, 60 miles per gallon out of a thing like that with hardly any work at all.
You had over-the-top ideas. Make everyone in the auto industry take sustainability classes. You had practical ideas.
Women are driving cars, and women carry handbags.
So make a special place where we can put them already. You had suggestions for alternative fuel sources.
Methanol.
You wanted to bring back those old wing windows to replace AC. Of course, we know the car industry does not work on the suggestion box principle. At least the car industry as we know it doesn't.
I'm Scott Redman. I am CTO for XP Vehicles.
On the 12th floor of a San Francisco skyscraper, Scott Redman is trying to change how the car industry works. Scott is a product developer. He likes to say venture solutionist, with patents on all sorts of software and medical technologies that have become industry standards. Now, he's brought together people from Silicon Valley, Detroit, and NASA, plus regular folks who email him suggestions, to create a totally new kind of car. It'll be electric, run by a rack of cell phone batteries, and it will be inflatable.
But it's we shun that term because people think about something that's kind of comical.
So what should I call them?
We call them pressure membrane structures.
But I might at some point have to say inflatable.
Yeah, everybody eventually does. We're haunted by that.
So if I open the door or hit the side of one of these, what's it going to feel like?
Since we're on radio, I have a piece of a car right here. So I'm going to go over here and get it and thump it and bang it for you. This is me banging on the door of the car. I'm going to take this door of the car and whang it on the desk here.
Think of airbags once they've been deployed. The entire car would basically be made of them, sculpted into different shapes so they look like regular seats and car doors and dashboards. Since the car is mostly made of air, it takes less energy to drive it. It's super, super light. It's also super strong and super safe. The rover that crash-landed on Mars was protected inside a vessel like this. Scott's done tests where he took early prototypes of the XP.
Put watermelons in them and hit them with SUVs and Hummers, and the watermelons were fine.
XP is just one of many new car companies cropping up in Silicon Valley with wild ideas. Scott says it's not that Detroit doesn't have innovative thinkers, too.
All the big car makers have had heads of technology, and they've all shown really cool things. But somebody at the top has to say, oh, that's a really cool thing, and pull the trigger on it, say, oh, that's what we're going to do. And they have to be incentivized to do that.
There is no incentive like the imminent collapse of an industry. And Scott says in the last few weeks, his company has moved from the fringe towards the mainstream. Lead engineers at Detroit car companies are sending him resumes. He was invited to Washington, D.C. this week to meet with top congressional committees. He says doors have been opening that he never imagined. Literal doors.
We got to go in a wooden leather room in the Senate with no windows where you can just tell they used to make smoky deals and get inside tips about who's really doing what with who. And it was one of the most incredible events of my life.
In the next few weeks, as the big three car makers find out if they'll get their billion-dollar bailouts, Scott will find out if his company gets the $45 million loan he's applied for, part of a new congressional push to jumpstart the green car market. If he gets the loan, he says test models of the XP will be on the road in 90 days. I casually bring up one of the ideas that you guys, our listeners, sent into the show and tell him he should really think about adding wing windows.
We don't have a design currently that exploits that, but that is a very good comment. And I'm going to now ask my engineers more about that.
And he looks totally serious. In San Francisco, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
The doors that seem to be opening for Scott may now be closing. That loan that he mentioned, Congress is currently discussing whether to redirect that money from fuel efficiency to a short-term plan to rescue the big three.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And Constant Contact, dedicated to the success of small businesses and nonprofits. You can learn about email marketing at constantcontact.com.
Barack Obama is nominating people whom he's disagreed with to join his cabinet. Also, he's decided to wear pants that don't fit and eat food that he hates. Good news, bad news, no news, next on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We're just going to go with the blanket categorization of bad news on the economy this week. We found out that we've been in a recession for a year. Unemployment numbers are high. The American automobile industry may be about to collapse. So, yeah, bad. Check that box. But other issues, not so clear. Here to sort out the news of the week into good news, bad news, or no news is this week's panel. Seattle-based radio host Luke Burbank. Hello, Luke.
Hi, John.
Television host Sophia Dickens. Welcome, Sophia.
Thanks, John.
And from the New York Times, Jennifer Ait Lee. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Our first topic. On Monday, Barack Obama announced his security team. It features his primary opponent, Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, George W. Bush's Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, sticking around at the Pentagon, and Jim Jones, who supported John McCain as National Security Advisor. Yep, the team of rivals. Are Obama's appointments good news, bad news, or no news? Luke, what do you think?
I think this is no news. I mean, I think that the cell phone clipped into the belt of the pleated Dockers while he rides his mountain bike with a helmet says everything. This guy is a pragmatist, if nothing else. And I saw a quote, which is, Obama is probably going to make his supporters on the far left way more angry during his time in office than he is the people on the right who didn't vote for him.
And so why is this no news?
I think anybody who watched him closely would say, yeah, this seems about right for this guy. He's going to put people around him that don't agree, and he's okay with differing opinions. And in fact, he might actually, you know, have a little bit more more of the middle in him than you'd even think. Hence Robert Gates.
Sophia, what about you?
I agree with Luke. These are wise choices on the part of the president-elect, and perhaps not as extreme as of a group of rivals as Abraham Lincoln's cabinet. I mean, it's not like McCain made the cut, but these folks are moderates and they're pragmatists, just like Obama promised.
Jennifer?
I think it's good news. I mean, I think, you know, the idea that you have very strong personalities with differing opinions that can debate each other is good for national policy. And, you know, when you kind of look back at Lincoln's sort of team of rivals, you had some people who had some pretty radical ideas. So, you know, William Seward, who was the Secretary of State right before the Civil War got into like a very interesting dramatic period, actually proposed, you know, provoking a war with France or Spain in order to unite the United States. And luckily, you know, Lincoln decided to sort of nix that idea. But it was sort of a strong, differing kind of opinion. And in the end, you can see, at least with Lincoln, the fact that he was able to shrewdly maneuver through those strong personalities.
Moving on. A new website, gradefund.org, lets students help finance their educations by signing up sponsors, friends, families, companies even. The size of the donations vary according to how good the students' grades are. The money is then sent either to the student directly or to the financial aid office. Is this plan good news, bad news, or no news? Jennifer?
I think it's fantastic. I think that as long as we're not doing it with taxpayer money, these are great in part because I think it takes out the stigma of doing well in school and therefore like realign some of the motivations and incentives.
I can't figure out how it's not good news. I mean, what is the downside to this? A kid like selfishly gets straight A's for their entire school career and
how
at the end
you?
They renounce it. Like, the joke's on you. I was in it for the money. I am forgetting the capital of Luxembourg even as we speak.
Sophia, what do you think?
Oh, I think this is great news. And as far as parents are concerned, America really promotes the spirit of giving and the idea of choice. So say my little Johnny isn't doing well in school. Well, I can also financially support another child who excels and really makes me proud.
Hedge your bet. I'll take the 6-4-3 in the fourth race at Saratoga.
I can put a bumper sticker on the back of my car saying, my child made the honor roll.
In my personal life, I don't believe in this. Like, I don't believe in giving my daughter money as a reward for good grades. But I think, generally speaking, I'm fine with it. Like, if she just gets it from someone else, it's cool.
I don't have kids, but if they manage to convince other people to do that, like, power to them.
And Jennifer, you're welcome to sponsor my kids as well. I offer that as a gesture to you.
Yeah. If they Facebook me, I would consider it.
Awesome.
If they can find me on Facebook, yeah.
All right, we need to move on. Last topic. Bratz are dolls that are kind of like Barbies, but with more makeup and pouty expressions. They were invented by Carter Bryant years ago while he was working at Mattel, which is the company that also makes Barbie. On Wednesday, a judge ruled that manufacture of Bratz must stop immediately and that the dolls must be recalled from shelves after the first of the year. It's a ruling that could have a huge effect on the toy industry. Is the ruling good news, bad news, or no news? Sophia Dickens.
I think this is good news. Maybe these Bratz can take this time off the shelves to retire their fishnets and put some decent clothes on.
Thank you.
I can't believe we've come to a place where Barbie is actually the wholesome conservative one.
I think it's bad news because I think on one hand, Mattel is being very, very severe here and the idea of them owning the thoughts that someone had
while they're working for them.
Yes, but I mean, I understand you sign things, but just the idea that if you had a thought as you're driving down the road and you worked for Mattel, they owned that thought, it's a little Orwellian. It scares me. But on the other hand, Bratz are basically the worst thing that's ever happened to America. And that includes the Civil War. That includes, you know, Pearl Harbor. And so the fact that there's going to be maybe less of them made for even a day is kind of great. So I'm conflicted.
Sophia?
This is just funny because I would have loved to be sitting in on this design meeting because, as I understand it, I think he actually drew up the plans while he was working at Mattel.
Right. It was the original drawings that are really actually at issue in this case.
I mean, can you picture sitting in this meeting and him throwing this out there to everybody? Okay, let's take Barbie and let's make her shorter, fatter, less talented, and grumpy looking. And all she wants to do is shop. And let's market her and make billions of dollars. Well, I can't really knock it because they did make billions of dollars. But I can imagine why nobody was in on the idea and he wanted to take it someplace else.
Jennifer, what do you think?
As much as, you know, Bratz are kind of slutsy, one of the nice things is they were a much more diverse kind of set than Barbie. I mean, Barbie, blonde hair, blue eyed for the longest time. Then they like came out with like the chocolate brown version just to sort of be more PC. But I think to a certain extent they were pushing not only on sort of the wholesome image of Barbie, but they were appealing to girls, you know, a little bit because they looked a little bit more like the little girls that are in America today.
Why does it have to be the lesser of two evils here? I mean, it's either Barbie or Bratz. I mean, can't we have something a little bit more clean?
Well, they're in the American Girls. What tops all of these is that FAO Schwartz, starting like last month, you can start making your own Muppet. You can go in, you can pick one of three bodies, and you can pick nose, eyes, hairstyle, and outfit. And you can walk out of there with your own Muppet. It's kind of cool, actually.
If the Bratz are off the shelves, I'm going to need something to fill that void. All right, now the news of the week makes sense. Thanks, panel.
Thanks, John.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Luke Burbank is a former NPR reporter. He hosts the radio show Too Beautiful to Live in Seattle. Jennifer Eight-Lee is a New York Times reporter, author of The Fortune Cookie Chronicles, and we were also joined by TV host Sophia Dickens.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
It's a gift-giving time of the year, which means soon your house will be filled with a whole lot of stuff. But where did that stuff come from? And where's it going next? Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. On September 11th, 2001, Indian-American poet Vijay Seshadri was in New York. He stood on his roof and he watched the towers come down. Last week, when terrorists attacked Mumbai, he couldn't pull his eyes off the coverage. Vijay says that when he thinks about the violence in his native country, when he thinks about any terrorist attack or bombing, there's a poem that helps him get as close as he can to understanding it.
It's a poem by Wisława Szymborska, the Polish poet who's a Nobel laureate. The terrorist, he watches. The bomb will go off in the bar at 1:20 p.m. Now it's only 1:16 p.m. Some will still have time to get in, some to get out. The terrorist has already crossed to the other side of the street. The distance protects him from any danger. And what a sight for sore eyes. A woman in a yellow jacket, she goes in. A man in dark glasses, he comes out. Guys in jeans, they are talking. 1:17 and 4 seconds. That shorter guy's really got it made and gets on a scooter. And that taller one, he goes in. 1:17 and 40 seconds. That girl there, she's got a green ribbon in her hair. Too bad that bus just cut her off. 1:18 p.m. The girl's not there anymore. Was she dumb enough to go in, or wasn't she? That we'll see when they carry them out. 1:19 p.m. No one seems to be going in. Instead, a fat baldy's coming out. Like he's looking for something in his pockets, and at 1:19 and 50 seconds, he goes back for those lousy gloves of his. It is 1:20 p.m. The time, how it drags, should be any moment now. Not yet. Yes, this is it. The bomb, it goes off. One of the things that makes the poem powerful for me is it gives me an insight that's terrifying. If you listen to the poem and remember the images, they're all rendered from a certain perspective, the point of view of the terrorist. And there's something horrifying about that when you realize it, that you are in the mind of the perpetrator of this act. And there's a real restriction on the part of the poet about making any moral judgment. The Mumbai experience for me was just seeing that on TV, and I feel the reality of the situation much more clearly when I read a poem like this than upon hearing news accounts.
It's been a dramatic evening in Mumbai. South Mumbai in particular, top tourist places, top hotels are under a terror attack.
You know, the most striking thing was the fact that it was perpetuated over this period of time. First, I think I just sort of said, oh, another bombing. And then when I heard about what had happened in the Shabad house, when I heard about luxury hotels that were taken over, when I, you know, had these images in my mind of people coming in little boats, there was a strange sort of intimacy, and you had time to think about what people were feeling. You had time to reflect on the ways in which you yourself would respond. I didn't see this as happening to other people. I saw this as happening to people who were my people.
Poet Vijay Seshadri was born in India, now lives in New York. He read The Terrorist He Watches, From Sounds, Feelings, Thoughts, 70 poems by Wisława Szymborska, published by Princeton University Press. You can read all the poems you just heard, and you can hear Vijay Seshadri read his own poetry at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This time of year, a lot of Americans are thinking about stuff. What stuff to buy for others, what stuff you might get, what stuff you can afford, what to do with old stuff. For filmmaker Annie Leonard, stuff has become a cause. She spent a decade researching where consumer goods, electronics, cars, food, all our stuff, where it comes from, how it's made, who buys it, where it goes. Last year, she released an internet video called The Story of Stuff that became a pretty big hit. She's still thinking about stuff.
Have you ever wondered where all the stuff we buy comes from and where it goes when we throw it out? I couldn't stop wondering about that, so I looked it up. And what the textbook said is that stuff moves through a system from extraction to production to distribution to consumption to disposal. Altogether, it's called the materials economy. Well, I looked into it a little bit more. In fact, I spent 10 years traveling the world, tracking where our stuff comes from and where it goes. And you know what I found out?
My name is Annie Leonard, and I investigate stuff. Whenever I go to a new country, I immediately start poking into the garbage cans, and first thing I do is go to the dump, because garbage is actually a tremendous window into what's happening in the society. India, for example, you'll see that there's hardly any paper or plastic in the dump. And the reason is because there are so many informal recyclers, often called rag pickers or scavengers, who are scouring the streets and the garbage can, pulling out valuable resources, the sort of detritus of the consumer lifestyle. The Philippines, Cairo, Delhi, all over the world, there are thousands and thousands of people who work and live on the dump, families, you know, including small kids barefoot rummaging through the dump. And these landfills are famous for having huge landslides. And so I've met people in the Philippines who lost children in these landslides of garbage. There was one family in particular who had 5 children, and 4 of them were killed by buried garbage. The mismanagement of garbage actually is killing children. I mean, I just was stunned by that, and I just vowed in my heart to do everything I could to make sure that that never, ever happens again.
We chop down the trees, we blow up mountains to get the metals inside, we use up all the water, and we wipe out the animals. So here, we are running up against our first limit. We are running out of resources.
There was a day a couple weeks ago where in one day I got an email from a 4th grader in Minnesota who had seen the film in her class, and she wrote to me and said it was totally awesome and put all these little smiley faces on her email. And I got an email from an economics professor at Oxford University who was asking if he could show it at his postgraduate economics classes. So more and more and more people are seeing it from all over the world, from China and Russia and Pakistan and Argentina and Kenya and South Africa. We're getting really positive responses.
To make toxic contaminated products. There are over 100,000 synthetic chemicals in use in commerce today. Only a handful of them have even been tested for health impacts.
I like to think of it as companies are producing and polluting on credit. And so they are producing these electronics that they're selling for dirt cheap so that we can get them cheap. But there are mounting environmental cleanup bills. There are mounting public health bills. In the long run, it's not good for the economy, either individually or as a whole.
Like BFRs, brominated flame retardants, they're a chemical that make things more fireproof, but they are super toxic. They're a neurotoxin. That means toxic to the brain. What are we even doing using a chemical like this? Yet we put it in our computers, our appliances, couches, mattresses, even some pillows. In fact, we take our pillows, we douse them in a neurotoxin, then we bring them home and put our heads on them for 8 hours a night to sleep. Now, I don't know, but it seems to me in this country with so much potential, we could think of a better way to stop our heads from catching on fire at night.
The fact that we put neurotoxins in a lot of our pillows, like you couldn't dream that up in the most extreme science fiction horror movie. We put those neurotoxins in our children's pajamas so that a mother cannot go out and buy children's pajamas that do not have neurotoxins. I mean, what are we doing as a society, dousing our pillows and our mattresses and our couches and our children's pajamas with these neurotoxins? They're now showing up in human breast milk.
Advertisements and media in general plays a big role in this. Each of us in the U.S. is targeted with over 3,000 advertisements a day. We see more advertisements in 1 year than people 50 years ago saw in a lifetime. And if you think about it, what's the point of an ad except to make us unhappy with what we have? So 3,000 times a day, we're told our hair is wrong, our skin is wrong, our clothes are wrong, our furniture is wrong, our car is wrong, we are wrong, but it can all be made right if we just go shopping.
Sometimes I look at my 8-year-old daughter and I think, what if she received that many messages a day that she was beautiful and that she was strong and that her skin color was good and that her hairstyle was good and all of these things that she's hearing the opposite from the mainstream media? I think it would have a profound impact on changing the tone of our society.
So we're in this ridiculous situation where we go to work, maybe two jobs even, and we come home and we're exhausted. So we plop down on our new couch and watch TV, and the commercials tell us, you suck. So you got to go to the mall to buy something to feel better. And then you got to go to work more to pay for the stuff you just bought. So you come home and you're more tired. So you sit down and you watch more TV, and it tells you to go to the mall again. And we're on this crazy work, watch, spend treadmill. And we could just stop.
You know, I think it's complicated. I don't think that the problem or the solution lies at the individual level. I'm very skeptical of these sort of lists of 10 simple things that we can do to change our lifestyle. So of course we should ride our bikes instead of drive and turn out the lights when we leave the room and buy local and organic and fair trade. Of course we should do those things. But the real solutions that we need to these problems are not available in even the greenest store. The choices available to us as consumers are limited and predetermined by forces far outside of our individual lifestyle. Really, what we need to do is come together with our allies and engage in the political process, which sometimes means taking to the streets.
Renewable energy, local living economies, it's already happening. Now, some say it's unrealistic, idealistic that it can't happen. But I say the ones who are unrealistic are those that want to continue with the old path. That's dreaming. Remember, that old way didn't just happen. It's not like gravity that we've just got to live with. People created it, and we're people too. So let's create something new.
We have a link to the story of Stuff at our website, weekendamerica.org. That story was produced by Chase Sabika and comes to us from the public radio website, hearingvoices.com. Speaking of stuff, I was out shopping the other day, and they were playing all the Christmas carols, the Jesus ones, the Santa ones, and then I heard one that's always kind of stuck with me. Good King Wenceslas, a song that has nothing to do with any holiday, but yet it's in heavy rotation everywhere. I don't know why. Have you ever listened to it all the way through? Here, let's break it down. Good King Wenceslas looked out on the Feast of Stephen, and right away, huh? Who's Wenceslas? What's he a king of? Why is he so good? Who's Stephen? Why does Stephen have a feast? We then learn that the snow was deep, crisp, even, and also roundabout. Soon, a poor man shows up collecting firewood. So Wenceslas sees this and asks his page who the guy is, and the page says, oh yeah, that guy. He lives out by St. Agnes Fountain. So the king says, hey, I know, let's get some firewood and wine, and we'll get some meat, and we'll bring it out to him. We'll walk. It'll be awesome. But on the way to deliver the wood and the snacks, the page gets really cold because you remember the snow, right? So Wenceslas tells him, walk in my footsteps. They give off heat. You'll be fine. And it works. The song ends by saying you should help out those less fortunate. And, you know, a good message, sure, at the holiday time. And there's some snow, so it's seasonal. But again, no Jesus, no Santa, no Hanukkah, no nothing. I found out that the Feast of Stephen takes place the day after Christmas. So this is really kind of a Boxing Day carol. Wenceslas was a Bohemian duke murdered in the year 935 by his younger brother Boleslas. Afterward, a sort of cult of Wenceslas emerged based on the legend of those warm footprints. And in 1853, a British liturgist wrote the song to teach kids about virtue. But there are zillions of songs about virtue. Why did this one become a hit? Why do we hear about a murdered 10th century Bohemian log and meat-bearing duke while shopping for iPods in 2008? Maybe it's the tune. It's easy to sing. Just a few notes do you need. It's in everyone's range. No one will sound too dumb reaching for a high note. Then you go up just a bit. Then you go back down again. Then you build up for the long notes. But by now you've warmed up. Then you go back to this part because there is no chorus. I talked to clergy, classical music people. No one knows why Wenceslas is a chart topper. It's at this point in these essays that I would normally tell you what I think the answer is, but I'm not going to do that. I don't want there to be an answer. Christmas is a narrow ritual. Every year we shop, we stress out about money, we follow traditions, and the songs are mostly about Jesus or Santa. But not Wenceslas. I love how obtuse that is. If there's a logical explanation, don't send it to me. I want it to just be this weird thing. It takes the pressure off. I'll keep singing it. And then for a change of pace, I might sing Jingle Bells, which has nothing to do with Christmas, was originally written for Thanksgiving, and is all about going too fast in horse-drawn sleighs.
Good King Wenceslas looked out on the feast of Stephen. And the snow lay round about, deep and crisp and even, brightly shone the moon that night.
The crash test dummies are with me on that. If you want to be warm this weekend, get to the West Coast. Unusually warm there, pretty cold everywhere else, but you can have fun no matter the weather. Here's Jeannie Yandel.
Texas isn't exactly tropical, but Rockport, Texas says, hey, it's warm here, kinda, during its Tropical Christmas Festival. 54 and cloudy, so wear a jacket over that tank top, check out pirate costume contests, photos with Tropical Santa, and wishing it was warmer and sunnier. Maybe save the shorts for a Christmas festival in Bermuda. This time of year is full of candy cane parades and holiday markets. Los Angeles offers the exact opposite with their Charles Bukowski tour. Sunny in 72, oddly cheery weather to check out the debauched writer's favorite CD bars and liquor stores. Visit the post office he hated working in and the home he hated marriage and fatherhood in. Happy holidays! Maybe a candy cane parade isn't such a bad idea after all. Chimney Rock is a 315-foot-tall monolith in North Carolina's Blue Mountains, and it's where Santa will be practicing his chimney descent skills. He'll be rappelling down the rock to prepare for climbing down millions of much shorter fireplaces. 41 and sunny to watch Santa and hope he doesn't fall, but once Santa's on the ground, he gets the biggest plate of cookies ever. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Exploring the music of tomorrow while working with the technology of yesterday, or 1989. A music festival of old video game systems, next on Weekend America.
Weekend America supported by Gather.com. If it's happening in the world, it's being discussed on Gather. People are talking about their weekends at Gather.com. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Table's How to Eat Supper, a holiday gift idea for people who love to eat. Now available at SplendidTable.org.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. People are playing video games in New York City this weekend, but playing them in kind of a different way. It's called Blip Festival 2008, and it features musicians who use antiquated video game platforms, old Game Boys, Nintendo Entertainment Systems, even Commodore 64s. They use special cartridges that allow them to manipulate the chips in the systems to make music. We spoke to three artists who will be showing their stuff.
Lightspeed Lament is a song that incorporates concepts of time travel, space travel, but also this theme of space age, sort of Romeo and Juliet story, I guess. I'm Jeremiah Johnson. I produce chip music under the name Null Sleep.
My name is Josh Davis. I do electronic music under the name BitShifter using standard issue 1989 Nintendo Game Boy.
My name is Timothy Lam, aka Trash Shady. I make Game Boy chip music and computer music. From the beginning, I wanted to do something that was more modern dance music, but I wanted to also integrate the Nintendo or the Game Boy or, you know, all those different pieces of hardware.
Chip music is essentially the practice of creating electronic music deliberately using
raw digital sounds, oftentimes produced using
dated or archaic home computer hardware or video game hardware.
And it also has to deal with trying to get the most out of something very simple, trying to exceed the limits of what the hardware is capable of doing.
I'm usually on stage with a mixer, a small mixer, and generally I have two Game Boys plugged into that mixer.
Two to three standard issue, off the shelf Game Boys from the big old original ones. I'm alternating between from Game Boy to Game Boy, and while all this is going on, ask anyone who knows me, and they'll probably point and laugh. But yeah, I do a whole lot of, you know, strange faces and fist waving and things like this to punctuate, you know, the parts that I'm particularly into. Genuine and unapologetic love for power pop. I will never outgrow it. Sometimes I wish I would, but I think I never will. So a lot of the material that I make is really sort of unsubtle and over the top in being, you know, melodic music.
Sort of age of really super produced music, I think there's something really nice about stripping a lot of that polish away and getting down to something that just sounds in a lot of ways dirty.
One of my constant challenges is trying to get human emotion out of these simple instruments. It's something that I struggle with constantly. It's so simple of a synthesis. And your ability to play something really soft and pretty and quiet and something really loud and angry, it's kind of limited in that aspect. Missing You was about my girlfriend who lives in another city, and she comes up on weekends, but sometimes I don't get to see her for a few months, so I kind of dedicated a song to her. I want that hard, low fidelity, awesome square wave. It's a very grungy, dirty, pure electronic sound.
Those voices you heard were artists Trash 80, Null Sleep, and Bit Shifter, all performing at the Blip Festival in Brooklyn, New York this weekend. We have links to all of their music at weekendamerica.org. And that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America. Our program is produced with, well, it's produced with antiquated video game systems, apparently, and also with humans. Ben Adair, Larissa Anderson, Sasha Aslanian, Julia Barton, Rob Byers, Hillary Frank, who will be eating Thanksgiving leftovers this weekend, she says. Yes, still. Michael May, Sam Keenan, who's catching a midnight movie, Michael Raphael, Chrissy Clark, Brendan Noonan. Ocean Kalen is in a law school final this weekend. Good luck, Ocean. Ariel Kitch, Desiree Cooper, Angela Kim, Mark Sanchez, and Chris Wieg. Our theme music was created by Galactic. Our executive producer is Peter Clowney. Jim Russell created the show. You can get a free podcast of today's program from our website, weekendamerica.org. I'm John Moe. I'm off to get my kids' pictures taken with Santa. The kids are bringing their hamsters. Sorry, Santa. Bye now.
Weekend America is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and by the Poetry Foundation, in support of the American Public Media Poetry Initiative. More information online at poetryfoundation.org. This program is also made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
The weekend is the perfect time to sit back and reflect.
There is some kind of sense of isolation and desolation that makes it like a dream moving around in some of these landscapes.
Look, traveling all across this nation can get expensive. Let us do it for you. I'm John Moe, host of Weekend America. Every week we take you across the country and show you what your friends and neighbors are doing and thinking. Join us.